Chapter 9. The sun was at its zenith, and the idea of moving from beneath the canopy of his tent didn't appeal to Lemuel one bit. Camille wanted to travel the secret path through the mountain again, eager to know what had drawn the thousand suns and space wolves into its high valley with such speed. The climb had almost ended Lemuel in the cool of sunset. He didn't want to think what it would do to him at noon. "Aren't you in the least bit curious?" asked Camille, reclining on a canvas chair and drinking water from a battered leather canteen. "I mean, what's got them all riled up that they needed to take battle tanks? Land raiders, no less. Did you see?"
"I saw," said Lemuel, dabbing his brow with his bandana. "They were impressive."
"Impressive?" said Camille incredulously. "They were more than impressive. They were amazing."
"Okay, they were amazing. But no, I'm not that curious as to what's happening in the mountain. I'm sure whatever is going on, we'll find out in due course."
"Easy for you to say," noted Camille. "You have a direct line to the Thousand Suns now."
"It's not like that," said Lemuel.
"Then what is it like?" asked Callista.
The three of them had taken to meeting each night since the arrival of the Space Wolves, their shared discussions of what Callista had written bonding them like conspirators with a dark secret. The more time Lemuel spent with Callista and Camille, the more he began to realize they shared more than one.
"Lord Adamant sees potential in me," he said, knowing his words were wholly insufficient to explain why the chief librarian of the Thousand Suns had sent for him.
"What sort of potential?" asked Callista.
Lemuel shrugged and said, "I'm not really sure yet."
"Come on, that's no answer," pressed Camille.
Lemuel's fear, when Adamant had told him he knew of his ability, had quickly faded, replaced with a simmering pride in his powers. He had long suspected that his ability to read people marked him out as special, and now he knew that was true. After spending time with Camille and Callista, he realized he wasn't the only one. He hesitated before answering, knowing he could be wrong, but wanting to be sure.
"After the other night, we know Callista has a talent for, what would the word be, channeling, I suppose. Channeling a power that allows her to write things that haven't happened yet."
"Talent's hardly the word I'd use," said Callista bitterly.
No, I suppose you wouldn't," agreed Lemuel. "Not if it's as painful as you say, but the physical manifestation of your ability aside, you can do things most people cannot, yes?"
"Yes," said Callista, nodding, and he could read how uncomfortable talk of her power made her.
"Well, I also have an ability," he said.
"What kind of ability?" asked Camille.
"An ability to see things that other people cannot."
Callista leaned forward, her aura revealing her interest.
"What sort of things?" she asked.
"Auras, I suppose you'd call them. It's like a glowing haze surrounding a person. I can see when someone's lying, read their feelings and moods, that sort of thing."
"So what am I feeling right now?" asked Camille. Lemuel smiled.
"You are overcome with feelings of unbridled lust for me, my dear," he said. "You want to leap on me and ravish me to within an inch of my life. Were it not for the presence of Mistress Eris, you would be astride me right now."
Camille laughed. "Okay, I'm convinced," she said.
"Seriously?" asked Callista.
"No," squealed Camille.
"I'm fond of Lemuel, but I prefer partners of a different flavour."
"Oh," said Callista,
looking away with a guilty flush. She looked at Lemuel.
"Can you really do that?"
"Yes, I can," he said. "Right now, you're embarrassed and wishing Camille wouldn't refer to a sexuality in front of you. You believe me, and you're relieved that you're not the only one with a secret."
"You don't need special powers to see that, Lemuel," said Camille. "Even I can see that."
"Yes, but you believe me as well, and you have a power too, don't you?"
Camille's smile froze. "I don't know what you're talking about," she said.
"Now, that's a lie," said Lemuel, rising from his chair and fetching himself a drink. "You touch things, and you know where they've come from, who owned them, and everything about their history, going all the way back to when they were made. That's why you always wear those gloves, and why you never borrow anything from other people. I don't blame you. It must be hard learning all of a person's secrets like that."
Camille looked away, her eyes downcast, and Lemuel smiled, trying to put her at her ease.
"I watched you touch that object buried in the ruins of the Ogoro house the other day," he said. "You knew what it was the moment you laid your hand on it, didn't you?"
Camille kept her eyes on the floor and said,
I did, yes. I haven't always been able to do it. I was about 13 when it started.
Don't worry, my dear, said Lemuel gently. We all have something special about us, and I don't think it's an accident we're here.
I don't follow.
Think about it. What are the chances that the three of us, people with talents beyond the understanding of most ordinary people, would find ourselves together like this? I'm no mathematician, but I suspect the odds are pretty much against it.
So, what are we saying? That we're here deliberately? Why?
Lemuel sat down again, sweating and breathless thanks to the heat.
I think our hosts may have something to do with it, he said. Look around. How few remembrances are there with the 15th Legion? 42 spread throughout the fellowships. A number like that makes me think there was a great deal more to our selection than our talents as remembrances.
So you're saying we were all selected by the Thousand Suns because we have these abilities?
Almost certainly, said Lemuel.
Why? Asked Callista.
That I don't know, confessed Lemuel. But if there's one thing I've come to know about the Thousand Suns, it's that they don't do anything without good reason.
The inside of the mountain was alive with sound and colour. Not any sound the Space Wolves could hear, despite their legendary heightened senses, nor any colour they could name, for these were hues of the ether, rippling like smoke and radiating from the smooth walls of the cave like bioluminescence. The armour worn by the Astartes was equipped with sensors that could penetrate darkness, but to those without ether sight, the view would be a sea-green monochrome, a poor rendition of the true light saturating the rock. 100 warriors delved the innards of the mountain, all that could be spared from the business of harvesting the gene seed of the fallen. Magnus led the way down, following a twisting path only he could see. Lord Skarsen and Othair Weirdmake marched with him, and Adamant took a moment to study the Wolf Lord. Skarsen's aura was a keen blade, a focused edge of single-minded determination. Here was a warrior who never let up, never stopped to question, and would never, ever falter in his duty. Such surety of purpose reminded Adamon of the golem legends written in the ancient Kabbalah. The golem was a creature shaped from clay, raised by an ancient priest to defend his people from persecution. It was a powerful, unstoppable force, a creature that obeyed its master's instructions absolutely literally, never deviating from its task, no matter what. It was a perfect representation for the Space Wolves, for Adamon had read accounts of the war they made. The Sons of Russ were weapons, a consummate force for destruction that absolutely would not stop until the job was done. Of course, the legends of the golem were also cautionary tales of hubris, with later tales depicting golems that had to be undone through trickery, whereupon they more often than not turned on their creators. The golem of Ingolstadt was one such beast, a monster that wreaked havoc on its creator and all he loved before destroying itself upon a polar funeral pyre. The comparison made Araman uneasy, and he put the thought from his mind as the tunnel sloped ever downwards. Normally, he could retrace any route, no matter how complex, but within moments of entering the mountain, he was utterly lost. Only the Primarch seemed to know where he was going, but how he knew which passage to take and which junction to follow was a mystery to Araman. Of the captains of the Fellowship, only Uthizar had come into the mountain. Phocis Takar was too weak, and Hathor Mart was restoring him with the healing arts of the Pavoni. Kalophis, too, had remained on the surface to secure the battlefield. The alien titans were no more, but who knew what other horrors might yet lurk in hidden valleys and caves. As a result, the Thousand Suns beneath the mountain were a mix of Astartes from different fellowships, and Araman saw ghostly flickers of power rising from each of them, subtly different, revealing their cult affiliations by the tempers of their auras. He noted that most of them were Pirae. I know, said Uthizar. Together with the Space Wolves, there will be no room for subtlety here. Adamon was about to nod when he realized he hadn't spoken the thought aloud.
Did you just read me? He asked.
It is hard not to at the moment, replied Uthizar. Everyone's thoughts are so heightened, with a level of etheric energy here. It is as if you are all shouting. I find it quite uncomfortable.
Adamon bristled at the idea of his thoughts being read. "Be careful," he warned. "That could get you into trouble some day. People do not like their innermost secrets revealed."
"My power is no different from yours," said Uthizar.
"How do you reach that conclusion?" said Araman. "The powers of the Corvidae and the Athenians are nothing alike."
"I read what people are thinking now. You read what they are going to be doing in the future. All that is different is the timing."
"I hadn't thought of it in that way," conceded Araman. "Perhaps this can form a debate for another day. This is probably not the best time."
"No," said Uthizar, with an amused chuckle.
They marched in silence for a while longer, following the crooked path deeper and deeper into the darkness. To feel the touch of the ether in the mountain after its chronic absence was both exhilarating and worrying. Nothing happened without reason, and only something of great magnitude could force the state of a thing to change with such extreme polarity. What lurked in the depths of the mountain that could effect such change?
The group lapsed into silence, each person pondering the implications of their shared abilities. Callista and Camille were relieved to share their burdens with others, yet wary of discarding a lifetime of secrecy in so short a time. It had bonded them. Whatever else might happen, whatever other journeys they might take, this shared secret had forged a link between them. For now, it was a fragile thing, but with careful nurturing, it might prove to be enduring.
"So, what do we do with this, then?" asked Camille at last.
"What do you mean?" asked Lemuel.
"I mean, what do we do?" said Camille, throwing her hands up as though he were being obtuse. "If you're saying that we're part of the 28th Expedition because of our abilities, are we supposed to know that's why we were selected? Can we use our abilities openly?"
Lemuel considered the question before saying,
"I would caution against that, my dear. Powers like ours are still considered witchery in some circles."
"Do you think we are in danger?" asked Callista, picking at a fold in her jalabia. "Is that why they've gathered us together, to get rid of us?"
"Oh, no, I don't believe so," said Lemuel hurriedly.
He stood and went over to her chair, taking her hand and looking her straight in the eye.
"I don't believe the Thousand Sons would go to such lengths just to have us burned at the stake."
"Then why do they want us?"
"I confess, I do not know for sure," he said. "Lord Araman says he wants to teach me how best to use my powers. I think we are here to learn."
"Why would the Thousand Sons care about teaching us anything?" asked Camille.
"Lord Araman said that by using our powers, we make ourselves vulnerable," said Lemuel, grasping for concepts he didn't know how to articulate. "I don't understand it really, but I got the impression that we're all part of something larger and that we're on the cusp of something wonderful. We could be the first of a new breed of people, people who can use their abilities safely and teach others to do the same."
Callista snatched her hand back, and Lemuel was shocked at the fear he saw in her face. Her aura shifted hue, turning from a soft yellow to an angry red.
"I don't want to be a new breed of anything," she said, pushing her chair back and rising to her feet. "I don't want this ability. If I could get rid of it, I would."
Lemuel stood and raised his hands in a placating gesture.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to push you."
"It hurts so much," she said, haltingly, pressing her hands to her temples and holding back tears with an effort of will. "Every time the fire comes, it burns part of me away with it. Unless I stop it, I'm afraid it's going to burn me away entirely one day."
Camille pushed herself from her chair and took Callista in her arms. "Don't be silly," she said. "We'll look out for you, won't we, Lemuel?"
"Of course," he said, "without question. People like us need to stick together."
"People like what?" said a voice behind them. Lemuel jumped as though struck and turned to see a frail old man in the beige robe of a remembrancer, with a long mane of frizzy white hair, only reluctantly contained in a wiry ponytail. Thin and stooped, he carried a slim, leather-bound book under his arm, and his walnut-coloured skin was ancient and deeply creased with great age.
"I'm not interrupting anything, am I?"
asked Mahavastu Callimachus, scrivener extraordinary to Magnus the Red. Lemuel was first to recover.
"Mahavastu, no, no, you're always welcome. Come in, won't you? I rarely see you these days. Magnus got you so busy writing his memoirs, you don't have time for your old friend."
Callimachus looked uncomfortable, and Lemuel read the unease permeating his aura.
"Is something the matter, my friend?"
asked Lemuel, steering Callimachus into the tent.
"I rather fear it might be," said Mahavastu.
"What is it?" asked Camille, getting up and allowing the old man to take her seat.
"It is the Primarch," said Mahavastu, placing the leather-bound book in his lap with a guilty shudder. "I fear he and his warriors are in great danger."
"What kind of danger?" asked Callista.
"The gravest danger," said Mahavastu. "The gravest danger imaginable."
They came at last to a great chasm in the heart of the mountain, a perfectly circular sinkhole, hundreds of metres in diameter. The roof above the enormous pit was a crystalline temple dome formed from the same substance as the Titans. The dome was pale cream, threaded with veins of crimson like the finest marble. And, like the Titans, its substance had been invaded with the black ropes of corruption. Thousands of glistening, pulsing black pillars rose from the pit like the roots of some unnatural weed. They pulsed with liquid motion, obscene mockeries of life-giving veins that fed on life instead of sustaining it.
"Great bones of Fenris!" hissed Garson. "What manner of beast is this?"
No one had an answer for him, their horror at the sight too visceral to put into words. Adaman moved through the stunned Astartes to the edge of the pit. A ledge ran around the circumference of the chasm, easily wide enough to drive a pair of land raiders abreast. Gold and silver symbols were worked into the bones of the rock, as though they had always existed and the mountain had simply grown up around them. Magnus stood at the edge of the chasm, looking in wonder at the impenetrable forest of oozing black tentacles rising from the pit. The lustre had returned to his skin, as though he were refreshed by the journey closer to the source of the power beneath the mountain. Othere Weirdmake and Lord Skarsen followed Adaman, joining the Primarch at the edge.
"What are they?"
asked Skarsen, kneeling beside the nearest symbol, a gold serpent entwined with a silver eye.
"Warding symbols," suggested Weirdmake, "like the wolf talismans we bear."
Skarsen touched the wolf pelt at his shoulder, and Adaman watched as all the space wolves superstitiously reached for various fetishes hanging from their armour. Those closest to Weirdmake touched the eagle-top staff he carried, and Adaman smiled.
"Superstition," he said. "The Emperor would not approve."
"An Astartes of the Thousand Suns telling us what the Emperor would not approve of," laughed Weirdmake. "Ironic, wouldn't you say?"
"No, I just find the gestures quaint," smiled Adaman. "Almost primitive. I mean, no offence, of course."
"None taken," replied Weirdmake. "But you too reach for a talismanic device." The smile froze on Adaman's lips as he realized the rune priest was right. Without even being aware of it, he had pressed his fingers to the silver oak leaf cluster on his shoulder guard, the icon that had once belonged to Ormuzd.
"Perhaps we are not so different after all," said Weirdmake.
"Perhaps not," allowed Adaman, turning his attention back to the thick ropes of black matter rising from the pit. Magnus stood immobile, as though in silent communion, and Adaman stood next to him.
"My lord," he asked, "what is it?"
"It's incredible, Ezek," said Magnus. "It's raw matter, the very stuff of the primordial creator given form." "Its rank is what it is," hissed Skarsen. "Any fool can see that. It's alive," hissed Uthazar, walking to the edge of the pit with sleepwalker's strides.
"Oh, it is alive, all right," nodded Magnus. "I have never felt anything quite so alive, not for a long time, not for a very long time indeed."
Adaman felt a thrill of warning along the length of his spine. Previously, the Primarch had labelled this power stagnant and dead.
"It's calling us," said Uthazar, and Adaman heard the dreamlike quality of his voice. "I need to go to it."
"What's calling you?" said Adaman. But no sooner had he spoken than he heard it, a soft whisper, like a distant friend calling from afar. It was not an unwelcome sound. It was gentle, a beguiling whisper, redolent with the promise of raptures beyond measure. Magnus turned to his captains and shook his head. Adaman saw that Magnus's eye was deep black, the pupil massively enlarged and swollen, as though filled with the same dark substance as the glistening pillars.
"My sons," said Magnus,
and Adaman felt the barely constrained power laden in every syllable.
"Concentrate. Rise to the 10th enumeration and shut out the voices. You are not strong enough to resist them.
I have dealt with power like this before. I mastered it then, and I will master it now.
Uthisar nodded, and Ahriman felt his consciousness rise into the uppermost enumeration, a place of inner solitude where a warrior could find peace, untroubled by the concerns of the world around them. It was an effort to reach such a state of mind, especially here, but Uthisar was master of his own psyche. Ahriman rose alongside him, and the voices ceased, shut off as surely as a vox-caster with a power cell removed. With the clarity imparted by the tenth sphere, Ahriman saw movement within the heart of the mass of tentacles, a flash of saffron and a glitter of something reflective.
"No," he whispered, his grip on the tenth sphere slipping as a flash of recognition surfaced. "Please don't let it be so."
As though in response to his words, the tentacle shivered, and a repulsive, slithering sound, as of a thousand greasy limbs moving together, filled the chamber. The space wolves were instantly alert, their guns snapping upright, though there were no obvious targets for their wrath beyond the black tentacles.
"What is going on?" demanded Skarsen.
Weirdmake's staff crackled with power, but the rune priest regarded it with horror, as though it had transformed into a poisonous snake.
"Spread out," ordered Magnus, "and stay away from the edge."
The gelatinous mass of plant-like growths rippled, and a number of thick stems detached themselves from the domed roof of the chamber. Like disease-ridden fronds in a polluted pool, the nearest tentacles sagged and spread as something moved through them, on a course angled towards the thousand suns. A black veil parted, and Ahriman's control of the spheres collapsed completely as he saw a wretched figure drift through the tar-black tentacles. Scraps of orange fabric clung to its naked body, which hung limp with its head down like a puppet bereft of a puppeteer. The figure was borne aloft by a host of slender tentacles, one a gleaming noose around his neck, another around his temple like a crown of obsidian. These tentacles were not like the others. Their vile substance was alive with gaping mouths and seething eyes that bubbled into existence before dissolving into nothingness. The figure drew nearer, and he lifted his head. His eyes were oil dark and reflective, and fine black lines threaded his skin, as though the black tentacles had filled him with their corrupt substance. A cracked mirror mask hung at his throat. The man's mouth was moving, as though he was screaming in unimaginable torment, but no sounds emerged, only a sopping gurgle of fluid-filled lungs.
"Is that?" asked Uthisar.
"It is," said Magnus sadly. "Yatiri."
Mahavastu Kallimachus hailed from the subcontinent of Indoi and was a meticulous recorder of data and a fastidious observer of details. He had scribed much of the earliest days of the Great Crusade and had been one of the first remembrancers to be chosen by the Thousand Suns. His reputation had preceded him, and he was immediately assigned to Magnus the Red. He had been at Magnus's side since the restored legion had departed Prospero in a fanfare of triumph, cheering crowds and billowing clouds of rose petals. He had recorded the Primarch's every thought and deed in a great tome that many called the Book of Magnus. Those remembrancers who found it difficult to collect any first-hand accounts of the Great Crusade from the Thousand Suns looked upon Mahavastu Kallimachus with no small amount of jealousy. Lemuel had met Mahavastu Kallimachus on the Fotep during a symposium on the best form of data collection, and their friendship had been born of a mutual love of detail.
"God is in the details," Mahavastu would say, as they pored over one of the many manuscripts in the vessel's fascinating library.
"You mean the devil is in the details," Lemuel would reply.
"That, my dear Lemuel, depends entirely on the detail in question."
Kallimachus was energetic, with the vigour of a man half his chronological age, which was somewhere in the region of 130 standard. Right now, Mahavastu Kallimachus looked every one of those years. The aged remembrancer opened his book, and Lemuel looked over his shoulder.
"An artist's notebook," he said, seeing the charcoal and pencil marks of an artist's preliminary outlines. "I never had you pegged as a sketcher. All seems a bit woolly for a man like you. None of the precision of language."
Kallimachus shook his head.
"And you would be right, Lemuel," he said. "I am not an artist. In truth, I am no longer sure what I am."
"I'm sorry, Mahavastu, I don't follow."
I don't remember drawing them, said Mahavastu in exasperation. I do not remember anything in this book, neither pictures nor words. I look back over every entry I have made, and they are a mystery to me.
Tears glistened in the old man's eyes, and Lemuel saw the anxiety in his aura replaced with aching sorrow.
Everything I have written, I remember none of it.
Have you had someone from the Medicaid Corps check you out? Asked Camille. I had an uncle who got old and his mind turned on him. He couldn't remember anything, even things you just told him. Soon he forgot who he was and couldn't remember his wife or children. It was sad, watching him die by degrees in front of us. Mahavastu shook his head.
I am familiar with such progressive patterns of cognitive and functional impairment, Mr. Shivani. So I had a Medicaid scan my brain this morning, he said. The neuron and synapse counts in my cerebral and subcortical regions are quite normal, and he found no atrophy or degeneration in my temporal and parietal lobes. The only anomaly was a minor shadow in the cingulate gyrus, but there was nothing that might explain all this.
Lemuel looked more closely at the drawings, trying to sort out some meaning from the ragged sketches and scrawled notations.
"Are you sure you did all this?" he asked, studying the strange symbols that filled every page. He could not read the words, but he recognised the language and knew that this was no ordinary book of remembrance. This was a grimoire.
"I am sure," said Mahavastu. "It is my handwriting."
"How do you know?" asked Callista. "You use a Scrivener harness."
"Yes, my dear, but in order to calibrate such a device for use, one must first attune it to one's own penmanship. There is not a graphologist alive who could tell the machine's work from mine."
"What is it? I can't read it," said Camille.
"I do not know. It is a language I have never seen."
"It's Enochian," said Lemuel, "the so-called language of angels."
"Angels?" asked Camille. "How do you know that?"
"I have an incomplete copy of the Liber Lowergate in my library back on Terra," explained Lemuel. Seeing their confusion, Lemuel said, "It's supposed to be a list of prayers from heaven channeled through an ancient magician of old Earth. It's written in this language, though I've only ever been able to translate tiny fragments of it. Apparently, there was once a twin book, the Clavis Angelicae, which had the letter tables, but I never found a copy."
"Enochian," mused Mahavastu. "Interesting. You must tell me more of it."
"In case anyone's forgotten, didn't you say that Magnus the Red was in grave danger?" asked Callista. "Shouldn't we focus on that?"
"Oh, of course, yes," exclaimed Mahavastu, flicking through the book to the last page, which bore a charcoal sketch rendered with quick, passionate strokes. The image seemed to depict a naked figure emerging from a giant forest, though, as Lemuel looked closer, he saw that it wasn't a forest at all. It was a nest of sinuous snake-like tentacles emerging from a giant chasm, and before it was the unmistakable form of Magnus the Red, ensnared by half a dozen of them. His warriors were also under attack, fighting for their lives in a giant cave within a mountain.
"What is it?" asked Camille. "I can't make head nor tail of it." "I have no idea," said Mahavastu.
"Lemuel?" "I can't say for sure, but I agree it looks bad."
"What's that word below the picture?" asked Callista.
Scrawled beneath the image was a single word, and Lemuel's blood froze in his veins as he realized it was one of the few Enochian words he understood.
"Penfidge," he translated, and Mahavastu flinched.
"What?" asked Callista. "What does that mean?"
"It means the thing that devours all," said Lemuel.